All right, Melissa, the last week of our listener suggestion block. What do you got for us?
Thanksgiving weekend of 1998, and we are in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. A young woman who's vibrant, ambitious, and just starting out her new life fails to show up for her restaurant shift. When her friend goes to check on her, what he sees through the window is something from a horror movie. Stabbed over 100 times, no forced entry, no clear motive, and a suspect who would spend years denying what DNA made undeniable. This is the story of Corey Parker and the predator who watched her every move. I'm Melissa Spivey.
I'm Ed Hydock.
And this is Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode number 49 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast around. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, here with, as always, my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Hey!
What did you guys think of that new intro? We're trying a little cold open instead of the usual banter about whatever's going on in our life. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, tell us. Tell us if you liked it or not, or if you have something totally different, let us know.
Yeah, open to suggestion. Trying everything. No. Melissa, I think the big takeaway from today is that it was supposed to be a scheduled interview with a guest and one of our favorite fans, but due to a family emergency, she was unable to be here. So unfortunately, that means we had to come up with something different.
I know. It's such a bummer, though. So if everyone can send Shannon some positive thoughts and good vibes, we would appreciate it. And I'm sure she would as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Best wishes to Shannon and her family. And speedy recovery is all we'll say, not to divulge too much, but we didn't want to leave you guys hanging without an episode. So we decided to make this another listener suggestion case. And we will get into that in just a minute. But before we start, just a reminder that we are now releasing MU Minis, a little mini episode every Friday. It's basically a 5 to 10 minute kind of overview of a case that we wanted to share with you and get the word out about, but kind of a more straightforward approach. And you can find the minis on YouTube through your favorite podcast platform, or they're on our socials too, broken up into several parts. So, Melissa, what do you have for us today?
All right. So, for our last listener suggestion case, at least of this block, I picked one that was sent in by Tony C. And I had never heard of this case, but Ed, I'm actually wondering if you have. Ed doesn't know what case I'm doing because this was kind of a last minute thing. So, we haven't even discussed it, but I'm wondering if you know the case, because not only is there a Forensic Files episode, but there's also a Cold Case Files episode.
Oh, la-di-da.
I know. Like, I watched both of them, and there's a Dateline episode. But this is going to be about the murder of 25-year-old Corey Parker.
Corey Parker. That sounds so familiar, and I don't know if I remember it. I'm wondering when it fell in the... So I worked on the Cold Case Files reboot, which was like years later. So if it was one of the original episodes, I wouldn't have known it. But Corey Parker sounds familiar. I feel like it was covered, just not by me. Like, I've heard the name thrown around the office.
It was definitely an older episode of, like, the original Cold Case Files. But it wasn't super old. It wasn't a super, super old Forensic Files episode.
Okay. Well, maybe I did some stuff for it. Maybe we all had episodes assigned to us. So maybe it was just one that wasn't assigned to me. The name sounds so familiar.
Well, let's get into it. So it is Friday, November 27th, 1998, and it's actually the day after Thanksgiving, so it's Black Friday, my favorite holiday, and we are in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. So Jacksonville, Florida is like one of Florida's most populated cities, and then all the way to the east of the city are three beaches that are considered part of Jacksonville. And the three beaches are Atlantic Beach, which is the northernmost of the three, then Neptune Beach in the middle, and then finally, Jacksonville Beach is the southernmost of the three. So if you were to pull up Google Maps, Neptune looks to be almost like a straight line east of Jacksonville. And it's about a 30-minute ride if you're driving from one to the other. But the three beaches, Atlantic, Neptune, and Jacksonville Beach, they're all really close to one another. They're just like a few minutes in between them. It kind of reminds me of like the Jersey Shore points on the East Coast, how it's like a new town every couple minutes almost. Well, our case today takes place kind of across all three beaches. So that's kind of where we are geographically. Now, we're going to begin our Black Friday, not shopping like we should be, but at a restaurant called Ragtime Tavern Seafood and Grill. And Ragtime Tavern was a really popular restaurant, and it was kind of in between Atlantic Beach and Neptune Beach. And it was pretty much a Jacksonville staple. Like, it was known, at least in the most recent years, for their craft beers and their made-from-scratch dishes. And Ragtime had opened in 1983, and actually, it just permanently closed a couple of months ago. So it had been around for a really long time.
That is a long time.
Yeah, it was like over 40 years, I think. So, like I said, it's Black Friday 1998, and the tavern had been closed the day prior, so everybody's coming back after the holiday. All the servers are ready to make some money. I know that I spent about 20 years in the restaurant industry, and Black Friday is generally a big money-making day.
I have shopped on Black Friday, and I see the chaos that is everybody out and about, so I imagine it's kind of prime time to be a waitress or a bartender.
Yeah, that whole week of Thanksgiving is bank money.
Wow.
So everyone's at the restaurant, they're getting ready to open, and everyone soon realizes that one of the employees, 25-year-old Corey Parker, still hasn't shown up. And this is really unlike Corey. She's super responsible, she always got to work on time, or at the very least, she would call to say she was running late.
Okay.
And Corey not being there, because like it was a big deal because everyone knew her. First off, Corey was gorgeous, and she was super tall. She was like 5'11", and she loved wearing heels that made her even taller.
Oh, wow. So looking at a picture of her, like between her height and her looks, she could have been a model, easy. And like, I imagine turned plenty of heads.
Exactly. Like, she walked into a room and people took notice. And not only was she tall and gorgeous, but she was incredibly bubbly and upbeat. Like, everyone who they interviewed talking about her was like, she was so bubbly. So the restaurant guests loved her as well. And by all accounts, you know, her coworkers and managers loved her too. So when she still hadn't shown up a couple minutes later, one of the cooks, who happened to be a really good friend of Corey's, was like, "This is really weird. I'm going to head over to her house and just check on her. Like, maybe she overslept."
Yeah.
And the manager on duty agrees. So off goes this friend. It was just a short, like, 5-ish minute drive to Corey's apartment. So the friend gets there. And this was kind of an apartment complex, although I'm not sure how many buildings there were total. I know that there were at least two buildings, like, right next to each other with a sidewalk in between. Okay. And these buildings are just basically like giant squares. And each building had at least four apartments total. So there's two apartments on the first floor and two apartments on the second floor.
Okay.
And the first floor apartments, they each had their own front door, which then led out to the sidewalk in between the apartment buildings. So it wasn't like Corey had to walk through a main door and through a lobby and down a hall or anything like that. Like, she could just go to her front door and get into her unit.
That's actually a really important piece of information for the listeners who are trying to figure out the whodunit aspect, because that pretty much defines who had quick access and who didn't.
Exactly. So this friend arrives at the apartment and he knocks on her door, but there's no answer. And this is 1998, so, like, cell phones aren't an everyday item, and I feel like only, like, important, rich, CEO-type people had them.
I had one, so that tracks.
You had one in 98?
I did. That was my first one. It was about this big, but...
Oh, my God. Wow. You're so important. And you had an intercom, which we learned back in October.
I was going to college, so...
So it's not like the friend could just, you know, call someone. And when Corey doesn't answer the door, the friend turns around, drives back to the restaurant. And when he gets back and lets everyone know what happened, the manager's like, "All right, something is really not right here. Go back again."
Hey, cue the crow. He's going back.
Cue the crow. Mm-hmm. So the friend drives back to Corey's apartment, and this time he walks around the side of the apartment. The blinds were all drawn, but like there was kind of a little corner of the window that he could see through, and it was into Corey's bedroom. And it's there that he can see a foot completely covered in blood.
Awful.
So this friend, coworker guy, is horrified, and he gets in his car and rushes back to the restaurant. And I can't even imagine what's going through his head. But as he gets back and relays the news to everyone, the manager quickly calls police to report that something was very wrong and they needed to get over at Corey's apartment ASAP. So police got there a few minutes later. It's about 11:45 at this point, 11:45 a.m. And they aren't sure which apartment is Corey's, so they knock on the first door that they see. And 18-year-old Ashley Berg answers the door. And the police are like, "Are you Corey Parker?" And she's like, "No, she lives, Corey lives over there," and points towards the other door. So police walk over the door and they're kind of inspecting it, and there's no signs of forced entry. So they knock a few times and they get no answer. So they decide to walk around the apartment like the friend did. And they discover that out of all the windows, one was unlocked. And this window went to her kitchen. And like, of all the windows in the apartment, this is the only one found unlocked, which is kind of weird.
And that says to me that either she like used this window often enough to leave it unlocked. Maybe it was like she would do dishes often and just open the window, or it was the point of entry. So it's kind of too early in the story to tell.
Well, police end up being able to see like her foot, which is what her friend saw. So they have probable cause to enter the apartment. When they get inside, they are stunned at this gruesome crime scene. Like, Jacksonville is certainly not the safest area. This was a ruthless execution. There's actually a reporter on the Forensic Files episode, and he talks about how there was just so much blood on and around Corey that it looked like she had been painted with blood.
God.
I can't even imagine. And then there was like blood splatter all over the walls. It was brutal.
Okay, so that level of overkill immediately to me screams personal attack, which would explain why there's no forced entry, because if she knew her killer, she would have let him or her in.
Oh, just wait. So Corey's found completely naked. She's laying on her back in her bed with her legs spread open. And this position can often indicate like a sexual motive to the crime.
Or a staged crime scene. It's kind of, again, too early to tell.
True. Well, police would later learn that although Corey was purposely, like you said, staged or positioned in that manner, the medical examiner found no evidence of a sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. Well, that means so the killer wanted police to think that she was that there was a sexual assault, which did like throw them off. And they were probably too stupid to realize that a rape kit would kind of prove one way or the other, because DNA was being used plenty in 1998. So you can't use the old like it's 1985. They didn't know about DNA.
And DNA definitely is, like, at the forefront of this case.
Okay.
So we'll come back to the autopsy in a little bit, but back to the apartment, there's really no sign of a struggle, like, in the apartment or anywhere but Corey's bed, kind of. So police believe that Corey was attacked while she was sleeping, and it was clear that she fought her attacker. I mean, she fought for her life. She was just covered in defensive wounds, but unfortunately it did not make a difference. So I don't have a ton of information on Corey, but I do want to tell you what I have. Corey Lynn Parker was born on August 15th, 1973 to Bruce and Liz Parker. I believe she was the youngest of two. I know she had a sister named Kimberly. Corey had grown up in Rochester, New York, and had graduated from Brighton High School, where she was a cheerleader. She was super popular and, again, bubbly. Like, that's how everyone described her. So Corey had gone to college up in New York, and then she kind of had eventually decided that she had had enough of Rochester's cold weather. And I get that.
Yeah.
And she was ready for some fun in the sun. So she moved to Florida and she started waitressing while she put herself through college. And Corey had made a ton of really great friends in Florida, and life was going really well for her. Like, especially because at this point, she was finally able to afford her own place, like without a roommate or anything. So this was like her first taste of independence.
Oh, totally. I mean, she's thousands of miles away from her family. She's in a good place financially. You know, she's probably flying high and just ready to start her own life.
Yeah, she just like, it was like everything was finally kind of falling into place.
That's always sad when I hear that too, because you these people are doing, changing something, which is, a change is so stressful. So they make this change and it bites them.
Well, and we'll find out, she had been in Florida for a few years at this point, but this was a pretty new apartment. So keep that in the back of your mind. We'll come back.
Okay.
So back at the apartment, police and forensic techs are inspecting this apartment from top to bottom. And soon they come across a gold Zippo lighter. And it kind of had some sort of logo or like emblem on it. And it was confirmed that Corey did smoke, but no one recognized the Zippo. Her friends are like, that's definitely not hers. So police eagerly send the Zippo to the crime lab to dust for fingerprints. In the meantime, they find even more evidence throughout the apartment. They discover blood stains in the kitchen, like next to the sink. And then they also see two blood smears on the windowsill above the sink. Like someone had taken their two hands and put them flat on the windowsill to like lift climb, themselves, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Or climb in. Okay.
Exactly. And as you can probably guess, this was the same window that had been unlocked.
So the likely point of entry. Now that there's handprints there, that kind of seals the deal.
Yeah. So at this point, police are pretty sure that this window was a point of entry and exit for the killer. Police also find foreign hairs in and around, like on Corey and around her. And one of these hairs still has the root intact. So this gets bagged up and sent to the crime lab. So keep the hair, the Zippo, and this bloody windowsill in the back of your mind. We will get back to them. But for the time being, all that stuff is at the crime lab. And of course, things still take a while nowadays, but it is 1998. So this stuff is not done overnight.
Right.
So after police are finished investigating the crime scene, they start canvassing the neighborhood. And there are a ton of apartments in this area. So this is a big undertaking. But they do end up learning some valuable information. Apparently, Corey had just moved in about 2 months prior in September of 1998. And she had quickly befriended the girl who lived next door to her, that girl Ashley, who had directed police to Corey's apartment when they first arrived. And Ashley told them that Corey liked living there, but she had been feeling really uneasy lately due to her apartment being on the ground floor. And like where her apartment was, it was about 3 blocks from the beach and it was close to nightlife. So there's already a lot of people in and out of this area.
Well, yeah, that makes total sense why she'd be kind of a little uneasy, you know, because not to mention she's young and this is also her first kind of taste of the real world and independence. So I think she has every reason to be scared.
Absolutely. And then to make it worse, another neighbor had told her that they had seen a young guy peeking inside of her front windows.
It was ground floors. They are dangerous.
I know. So now that police have this information, they want to put together a timeline of Corey's night, like leading up to her murder. So they begin talking to her friends and they quickly get an idea of Corey's whereabouts the previous evening. So that was Wednesday night, the night before Thanksgiving, and Corey had gone out to a bar with some friends. And this bar was like one of her regular hangouts. It was called The Ritz. So Corey was out with her friends. There were pictures of that night and they looked like they were having a really great time. And Corey left around 1 a.m. and the investigators could tell, like, she definitely did make it home because the clothes she had worn to the bar that night, they were like neatly taken off and folded at the end of her bed. So she was probably going to like wear them again the next day.
Right. Yeah.
So she had clearly come home. She had changed out of her clothes and she had gotten in bed.
So that makes me wonder if someone broke in after she was asleep, as they kind of suspect, or maybe they were lying in wait in the house already before she got home, just kind of waiting for her to fall asleep. Especially if this was someone watching her, they would know her schedule. They might know when she comes and goes and know her routines. So maybe they were waiting there for her.
Well, police have pretty much the same questions that you do. But now that they have an approximate timeline, and we kind of have more at this point, more information from the autopsy. So The medical examiner confirmed that Corey was not sexually assaulted. And we also learned, this is according to the Forensic Files episode, Corey had been stabbed 101 times.
I'm sorry, what? You 101, you said?
101 times.
I don't have words for that. I've never heard of anyone being stabbed 101 times.
It's wild. And like, for lack of a better phrase, that is extreme overkill.
Yeah.
Now, I will say the medical examiner was able to tell that 54 of the stab wounds had happened post-mortem.
That's even worse.
That's a lot of anger. Almost like the killer like couldn't control him or herself.
Couldn't control is the understatement of the century. I mean, that almost guarantees that Corey knew her attacker, because no one aside from just a thrill killer or a complete psychopath, you know, serial killer type, would take such time in an unfamiliar place for the fear of being caught. Like, that's, it takes a long time, and there's a lot of anger in there. Like, what?
No, you're right. And on the Dateline, I believe, they were talking about how a lot of the wounds that had been made after her death, they were like on her stomach, and they were kind of smaller. Like, the killer was just going, like, making short, quick steps. It was a very odd crime scene.
There's something called hesitation wounds, which I learned about. I was doing a piece for True Crime News on the Ellen Greenberg case, which that's a local case. You guys can all Google Ellen Greenberg, but she had a ton of stab wounds, but a lot of them were like, they were from somebody who almost had never stabbed someone before. So it was like you were testing.
Yeah.
Hesitation wounds are called.
I don't know, because like I said, this was after she was dead. It was just like the killer just wanted to inflict maximum.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awful. So let's move on to suspects, because my goodness, like once police start digging, it seems like suspects in this murder were coming out of the woodwork. So Corey just recently started seeing a new guy. His name was David Wilt. And I mean, this relationship was super recent, like within the last 3 weeks or so.
The reason I'm laughing at David Wilt is because, do me a favor and go in and check the Forensic Files credits on that one, because I got $20 that says it was an assistant producer named Aaron Wilt, because we used to make up our own aliases back in the day.
It's funny you say that, because later in the episode, I'm going to introduce you to two people. They had different last names in Forensic Files than they did in the Dateline and the Cold Case Files.
Oh, man. I know there's at least one that there's a Tad Haydock or something in there.
Oh my God. Yeah, the guy's name was like Frank Jones and his real name is like something. It's wild. But
yeah.
So, of course, they're going to look at her boyfriend, because as we have seen in countless other true crime stories, including like the one we covered last week, I think, it's generally the husband or boyfriend. So police look at him and he is very, very quickly crossed off the list. He actually hadn't even been in Florida at the time of Corey's murder. He had gone to his parents' house for Thanksgiving, and that was like somewhere out of state.
That makes him quick for police to rule out, though.
Right. So that was good. Get him off the list. So after talking more to her friends, the next person they look into was this guy that Corey had worked with. I believe he was a dishwasher at one of the restaurants she had worked at. And he was 27-year-old Eric Ely. And Eric pops up on their radar because once they get Corey's phone records, they can tell that Eric had called her several times the night she was murdered. So the excessive phone calls are a little bit weird, but then police discover that Eric had a big, big, big crush on Corey, and he had asked her out several times, and each time Corey politely turned him down. He had even asked her to come over for Thanksgiving dinner, like just the two of them. And this is so creepy. Oh my God. The reason for all those phone calls that night was because he had gone ahead and made like this big Thanksgiving dinner. And so that way he could call her and be like, oh, I made this whole dinner for us. Come over.
I don't know.
No.
You say creepy, but part of me, like, that's kind of sweet. He's shooting his shot. Maybe it was innocent, but you know what? Depending on how this guy was wired, all of these rejections, if he is a true suspect or the guy who ends up doing it, like, that may have been enough to set him off.
But we also need to remember that if someone tells you no, especially more than once, no means no and move on.
But you didn't say don't make a turkey.
So now, ladies, you hear this? Anytime you turn a guy down, tell him no for a date and no for a turkey dinner. Clear, get it all out there. So police are kind of wondering, did this guy kill Corey in some sort of like, how dare you reject me? And if I can't have you, no one can type of situation. Because we see that a lot. And maybe it's a bit of a stretch until they talk to people at the restaurant who had worked with both Corey and Eric. They find out that Eric's big crush on Corey had stopped being a harmless crush and had turned into a creepy obsession. So police bring Eric in and nothing he does improves their opinion of him. He does tell them that he struggles with mental illness, but then he goes on to tell police how he has fantasies about raping and killing women.
Dude, those are the intrusive thoughts we always talk about. Like, don't say the quiet part loud.
What are you thinking, bro? Yeah. So police are like, tell us more about these fantasies. And he does.
Oh, God.
He tells them even more about these sexual fantasies, including violent ones that involve raping Corey.
Oh, my God, dude, just shut up.
And I'm guessing at this point, police are ready to like lock him up and throw away the key. But
seriously.
Eric keeps on talking, and at one point, the one investigator is trying to get him to admit that he was obsessed with Corey, and he's like, just admit it, you were obsessed with her. And Eric goes, yeah, I was obsessed.
Like, I totally was.
He right back at him, but agrees with him. It was very strange.
Wow.
So he goes on to tell investigators that he would have murdered Corey if he had the chance, and then he tells them how he would do it. So he goes into even more detail by explaining that one of the first things he would do is slit Corey's throat so that way she couldn't scream.
Okay. Hold on. I need a minute here to soak this all in, because this reminds me of James Cushing, when we did our Hollywood Horrors block, the guy who wanted to be Lizzie Borden, you know, and I do believe he was seriously mentally ill. And given what this guy's saying here, I believe that's kind of the case with Eric, too. So I'm like trying to take what he says with a grain of salt. The whole Thanksgiving dinner, maybe he's just awkward. And that was him trying to be like, this is me shooting my shot. I don't know how. I'm hoping that this chivalrous gesture will win you over. So maybe this guy just doesn't know how to process feelings of any kind.
I feel like you need to listen to him being interviewed, because the way he says it is very much almost like he's proud of it. Like, yeah, I was obsessed with her. Like,
well, but think about James Cushing, too. Remember the things he would say? Very confident. And he didn't know he was making him. Like, he didn't know these thoughts are bad. He's like, they're just thoughts. Why would you arrest me? I didn't mean it.
Yeah, I don't know. This guy was just not giving off good vibes, clearly.
Okay.
So he says that part about how he would slit her throat so that way she couldn't scream. And police are like, okay, we have a victim who was stabbed to death. And we have a suspect who says he would have cut her throat and killed her. So case closed, right?
Yeah, not looking good.
Well, no. After Eric finishes his murderous fantasies, he tells police, but you know, those are just fantasies and I didn't do it. And then he willingly gives up his DNA.
See,
so DNA gets sent off to the lab. Again, not instantaneous, so put that on the back burner. So let's talk about another suspect. I mentioned earlier that when police were trying to get a timeline of Corey's night, they had spoken to the people she had hung out with at that bar. And one of those people was a woman named Tiffany. Now, Tiffany was a newer friend of Corey's, and there was some speculation, and this is pure speculation on a couple people who were interviewed on their part, but was speculated that she may have had a romantic interest in Corey. She had supposedly told another, like a mutual friend, that she was bi-curious. And while it seems like Corey really did enjoy Tiffany's company, there was absolutely no indication of any feelings for her more than like a platonic friendship.
Okay.
So Tiffany claims that she and Corey left the bar at the same time, but they went their separate ways. Tiffany got in the car with a friend and went to another bar, and then Corey got in her own car and drove home. But then, this is according to the forensic files, Tiffany begins telling people that she called Corey around 2 a.m. that same night, so Wednesday night or early Thanksgiving morning. Mm-hmm. And when Tiffany asked her, like, hey, girl, what are you doing? Corey answers and was like, I'm asleep. And the phone call ends. So then Tiffany starts telling people that she drove over to Corey's apartment at 4 a.m. and knocked on her door, but there was no answer.
Man, these suspects are just planting themselves right in the crosshairs, aren't they? Jeez, yes. So now you have someone who just expressed a romantic interest and also mm-hmm. put herself at the crime scene during the window of death.
Well, it gets worse because then police find out that Tiffany was running around telling people specific details about the crime scene and the murder that had not been made public.
Oh, man, like what?
Like how she had been killed, how had she had been stabbed, like all this stuff that hadn't been released. So like, how did she know that?
Right.
But when police start talking to Tiffany, she claims she has nothing to do with the murder. So police are like, okay, well, give us your DNA. And Tiffany says no. She refuses to give her DNA. So seems like right now we have two pretty decent suspects.
Agreed.
Once police start digging a little bit deeper, they look at Corey and Tiffany's phone records for that night, and they also search Tiffany's car. So the phone records come back first and show that Tiffany had never called Corey that night when she said she did.
Ooh.
Which is weird.
That is weird.
Like, why would you make that up?
Why lie? Right.
Right. So then, a few months after Corey's murder, Tiffany packs up and, like, leaves Florida, where she had been born and raised in Jacksonville, at Jacksonville Beach. Mm-hmm. So she just packs up and leaves and heads to New Orleans. So police are like, is she running? Like, is she trying to put some distance between herself and the crime? So they eventually actually have to get a court order for her DNA.
Oh, wow.
And this is when police start getting, like, all the results back from the lab, like, from the beginning. So, first of all, there were no fingerprints on that random gold Zippo lighter. So, for now, that's a dead end. Nothing on it, nothing helpful. Then, there was no sign of Corey anywhere in Tiffany's car. So, that doesn't help. Mm-hmm. But from the lab, they are able to confirm that the blood on the windowsill was definitely not Corey's blood. So we think it has to be the killer's, especially because those foreign hairs they found match the blood.
Oh, okay. So that's connected now.
Right. The hair and the blood on the windowsill are from the same person.
Right. Likely the killer.
Exactly. So another thing they discover from the blood is the presence of a Y chromosome. And we're going to rewind back to 10th grade biology class where we learned the Y chromosome is only found in males.
Yep. And there goes Tiffany as a suspect. But I'm wondering if it was just she was clout chasing. You know, these people who are so desperate for attention, they just like to insert themselves. You see it all the time.
100%. So basically, police believe that Tiffany lied about the phone calls and visiting Corey's home at 4 a.m., like, in order to make herself seem more important to Corey, maybe, than she actually was.
Hmm.
And the reason she knew so much about the crime scene and, you know, how Corey was killed and what her body looked like, she had a friend who was a paramedic or something related that had worked on the crime scene.
Oh, gotcha. So he had seen Corey's body, essentially.
Yeah, this friend had seen everything that happened and went and reported it all to Tiffany. So, way to go on the HIPAA laws there, guys.
Yeah, seriously.
So, Tiffany basically just wasted everyone's time with, like, her self-important nonsense because they spent all this time chasing her down when she really had nothing to do with it. And she did say on one of the shows I watched that she got her nights mixed up about when she called her. But then on another one of the shows, She said she definitely called Corey and the call records must be wrong.
She's still clout chasing. If she's on one of these shows, she's still just, she's agreeing to do it so she can get her face on television.
She's in the Dateline and she spends the majority of it kind of whining that the cops were mean to her and bullied her and she's the victim. And I'm like, you're not, like, you still have your life. You need to stop.
Yeah. And if you don't insert yourself into the investigation, you can't be labeled a victim. Like, you can't, you know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. They wouldn't bully you if you didn't put yourself there.
Yeah.
So let's forget all about her because I'm over her. So police are back to Eric Ely, the guy who admitted to being obsessed with Corey and who then proceeded to brag to police about his violent sexual fantasies involving Corey. So police are shocked when the DNA at the crime scene doesn't match Eric's DNA.
I'm not. See, I think I might be reading too much into this, but I actually feel bad for Eric. He clearly needed help. I'm just picturing our other guy, James Cushing, because he needed help too.
See, Eric, I don't know. I'm going to have to look him up to see, because I would be willing to bet he's not living the straight and narrow lifestyle.
I'm curious to see. I'm interested, because I could change my whole tune on him the second I read more about him.
I'll Google it. Well, police are now pretty stumped because all of their, like, number one suspects kind of went out the window. So they begin asking for and testing the DNA of, like, every male that was in Corey's life. Anyone she had gone to class with, anyone she had worked with, anyone she had hung out with a bar that night, like, anyone. So they eventually tested almost 40 people. I think it was 38 men that they tested. Wow. Nothing came from it.
And that's a big, I think people underestimate how big of a task that is, because not only do you have to find these people, if they don't say yes, you got to get a warrant. And then, so you have to wait on that. Then you have to get the sample. So find them, get it, and then send it to the lab and then wait for the results. So 40, that's a lot of time and effort.
It is. And they've already spent a lot of time and effort on the other potential suspects.
Correct.
So basically now police are back at square one. And it's at this point that they begin to wonder, was this just a random attack after all? Like, as we said earlier, Jacksonville's a hot tourist spot. You know, there's the three beaches we talked about. It brings a lot of people. And police wonder if maybe this was just an opportunistic predator who happened to see Corey and took his anger out on her.
I think it's a fair theory, but if that's true, good luck finding the killer without the use of a database, you know, because if that was a tourist or someone trying to blend in with the tourists, they're long gone.
Or they could call Ken Brennan and find the guy.
Tomorrow, yeah.
Duh. So police would continue to work on Corey's case for the next year and a half without any progress. So finally, they decide to offer a $20,000 reward to anyone who could give information that led to arresting and convicting Corey's killer. And finally, they got a tip that would prove to be invaluable information. So a few blocks away from Corey's apartment was like a steak and barbecue type restaurant, and a few of the employees came forward to tell police that one of their former coworkers had been acting super strange around the time that Corey was murdered. So police are like, all right, well, like, what do you mean strange? Like, what did this guy do? So the employees share how right around the time of the murder, their coworker, Robert Denny, who was 17 years old at the time, he had come into the restaurant and he was like a hysterical mess. He's crying and carrying on. And he tells everyone that he needed to take some time off because his son, who lived in Texas, had been killed in a car accident. So, of course, his coworkers are like, oh, my God, we're so sorry. Like, anything you need, take all the time you need. We got you.
Yeah.
Then these coworkers even started like an employee fundraiser donation jar where they all chipped in money so Robert could go back to Texas. So once the employees had collected the money, one of the managers decided to take the money to Robert at home. When the manager knocked on the door, Robert's sister answered. And after the manager like explained who he or she was and why they were there, Robert's sister's like, what are you talking about? Robert doesn't have a kid.
Ooh, how often can crows come by? Because now I'm starting to...
There's a lot of crows in this story. So police are like, All right, well, that's a shitty thing to do, but like that just means he's a liar and maybe a con man, but it doesn't mean you're a kid. It doesn't mean he's a killer.
It's true. I mean, but if you're capable of telling a lie that grand, you know, then there's no telling what you're capable of.
Yeah. And so the coworkers go on and tell the police that Robert had told them that he had lived in an apartment complex and he was like really into one of his neighbors. Can you guess who that neighbor was?
Since I only know one person that lives there now, too, I would guess Corey.
Yep. So the coworkers go on to say that Robert had told them about this woman who lived in the building next door. And Robert, who lived on the second floor of his building, mm-hmm. he had a direct line of sight, not only to Corey's front door, also to her windows.
Mm.
And then he would tell his coworkers how he would watch this woman. And he even told them how he would masturbate while he watched her. Public service announcement. Your coworkers don't want to hear that.
Also, ever. Intrusive thoughts, people. Don't let them win.
Keep it to yourself. Just keep it to yourself.
This is the story of intrusive thoughts winning.
Seriously, if you need to share them with someone, you tell your pet. So police decide to pay Robert a little visit. And they had actually spoken to Robert back when the murder happened. Like, he was one of the people they talked to when they were canvassing the neighborhood. But they had pretty much crossed him off almost immediately. And part of that was because of his age. Because he was 17 years old.
If he ends up doing this, I'm going to be blown away because, I mean, where we're at in the story, I assume he does. But 17 years old, but that 101 stab wounds from a 17-year-old, like, that's messed up on so many levels.
It's so much more messed up. So police pay him another visit. And when they arrive, Robert's sister answers the door and she's like, oh, he does not live here anymore. And police are like, okay, like, well, why? So she goes on to tell them that, yes, Robert had lived there in the apartment with her and her husband, but they had had to kick him out basically for being a creep. The sister claimed that he was up at all hours of the day and night, and he was constantly watching porn to the point that she really thought he was addicted to it. And even worse, she woke up one night, and there's Robert standing in the dark in her room staring at her while she slept.
God, creeptastic. That's insane.
Which is also a James Cushing thing. Remember
exactly.
He did that?
He was standing over and didn't he pee on the floor and then go back to bed?
Something like that. Oh,
weird. So weird.
So police are now definitely interested in getting a hold of Robert. So while they're doing some digging on him, they discover that in addition to his sister, Robert had an older brother and his name was Patrick Denny.
Patrick Denny? This could be the ultimate throwback.
No H in Denny, D-E-N-N-E-Y. But it's funny, when we were researching the Patrick Dennehy case, this Patrick Denny guy kept coming up, and I just thought it was like a weird typo kind of thing.
Wow.
Isn't that wild? And then
it must have been like a search
term.
It must have been a search term thing when you associate the name with murder, that it could have been like a typo that they include in the results.
Yeah, so I kind of knew about this case before somebody sent it to us. Weird. But this was the fact that he had a brother was interesting to police because Patrick was currently in prison serving a life sentence because at the age of 15 years old, while he was living in El Paso, Texas, and working as a paperboy, he had raped and murdered 27-year-old Catherine Latimer, who was a customer on his paper route.
Wow.
This 15-year-old kid goes to her door. He's like, hey, you owe me money for your paper. And she's like, oh, sure, come on in. She turned around to grab her purse and he just began stabbing her. And get this, he stabbed her 96 times.
Not up. Like, yeah. This kid, it was literally idolizing his older brother, like actually following in his footsteps. That is insane.
Isn't that wild? Like,
the age.
His brother, 15 years old, 96 stab wounds. Now, he was Robert was 17 and it was 101 wow. stab wounds.
So unreal.
Patrick had been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Great role model.
Yeah, right? So police are shook. Like, now they have two brothers, two wildly similar crimes. And just like you said, they're like, is he trying to outdo his brother? Like, what is going on here? So police now really need to find Robert, and they need to talk to him ASAP. So they're able to track him down nearly 800 miles north in Easton, Maryland, where Robert was living with a married couple. He had met the 52-year-old wife of this couple online, and he somehow convinced her to let him come and live with her and her husband. Well, 19-year-old Robert and this 52-year-old woman had an affair behind the husband's back.
Well, that's how he got in.
I'm very confused.
Yeah, I'm not, but I let those intrusive thoughts stay. See?
I know.
Look what I just did. Look what I just did. Didn't say it.
Exactly. Keep it to yourself. So they pick Robert up, who, by the way, like I said, is 19 years old at this point, because it's a year and a half after Corey's murder. And they bring Robert to the station, and they decided they didn't want to bring up the murder to Robert, but instead they made up a fictitious crime to talk to him about. And they're basically hoping that they can trick Robert into giving them his DNA.
Sneaky.
Yep. So they're basically like, okay, we got reports that you were involved in some criminal activity here in Maryland, and we need to talk to you about it. And they told him facts, fake facts, that were like, they knew Robert was nowhere near the scene, or, you know, where he definitely had an alibi kind of thing.
Yeah, make him trust that it's not, has nothing to do with him. Simply
exactly.
Procedural. Yep.
And Robert plays right into it. He's like, what are you talking about? I haven't done anything. So police continue to question him about this fake crime spree. And during this line of questioning, Robert is smoking cigarettes. So police are like, oh, here's an ashtray for you, bud. Robert uses the ashtray to put out his cigarette, and then he takes a cigarette butt and either puts it in his pocket or behind his ear, because he smokes several of them.
That's pretty savvy, even for 98, you know? He's 100% onto them.
Which is so crazy, because, that he knew about DNA and how it was transferred and how it was collected, like, in 1998.
And at age whatever he was.
19, exactly. Mm. So police continue questioning him, and at one point they offer him something to drink, and they give him a bottle of water. Robert declines. They're like, no, you look thirsty. So he's like, fine. So he takes the bottle, never opens it, never drinks it.
They're like, here's a lollipop.
Yeah, right? Anything. So now police are like, okay, well, you said you weren't part of this crime spree, so maybe it's just a mistaken identity. Let's get you ruled out. So why don't you just go ahead and give us your DNA, and then, you know, this whole mess will be cleared up. And Robert's like, no.
No.
So police wait. They try even harder. They're like, oh, okay, that's fine. Well, you know, we're going to need you to sign a paper saying you refuse to give your DNA. So Robert's like, sure, fine. So he signs this piece of paper. And then police hand him an envelope, and they're like,
lick this.
Stick that paper right in here and, you know, seal that envelope.
Seal it up.
Seal it up real tight.
And put it in this mailbox.
Which is their hands, which is like a cardboard box. Which someone wrote mailbox in Crown. So yet again, Robert isn't falling for that, and he refuses to lick the envelope. He gives it back to them, and he's like, you can seal it. And by now, Robert has had enough, and he says something along the lines of, you have been trying to get my saliva all day. It's not going to happen, and if you aren't arresting me, I'm out. And, like, what can police really do? They don't really have anything on him other than him running his mouth about being a pervert to his coworkers and the fact that his brother is a murderous degenerate.
He clearly was not wearing a sign. I know that much. But you're right, though. A hunch is not enough to arrest somebody.
Exactly. So police have to let him go, but that doesn't mean that they forget about him. They begin tailing Robert and just watching his every move. And he pretty much only went to his house and his place of employment, which was like a computer store. So police watch Robert take smoke break after smoke break, but each time he keeps the damn cigarette butt and he doesn't discard it.
Smart.
By the way, the reason I quit smoking was not for my health, but more so that way no one could take a cigarette butt and plant it at a crime scene.
And clone you.
Dead serious. That is why I quit.
Wow.
So police keep up this surveillance for a couple days. And then one afternoon, Robert is at work and he goes outside to take a smoke break. Police are watching him, but again, they're really not expecting anything.
Right.
When all of a sudden, Robert spits into a nearby puddle that had formed earlier in the day when it had rained. And police are like, oh my God, did you see that? Like, they're so pumped. So Robert proceeds to spit a total of 6 times, like, into these puddles, which is fucking foul.
It's a guy thing. Spitting's cool.
Spitting is trash-tastic. But anyway, once Robert goes back inside to work, police jump out of this, like, surveillance van, and they get super lucky because due to these puddles, Robert's spit was just, like, floating on top of the water. It's so gross, but it does mean that they're easily able to collect, like, the entire wad of spit.
No shit. See, that's insane, and I'm not going to lie. I've never heard of anything like this in the 5 bajillion cases I've covered in my career. Like, this is a new one, and it's awesome. That's so
cool.
Isn't
it crazy?
Yeah.
Our listeners have picked way better cases than we ever
have. Oh, my God. Let them run this thing.
Seriously. You guys are on. Have fun. So police wait patiently while the lab examines the spit, and lo and behold, it matches the blood and hair found at the crime scene. Hmm. So police bring Robert back into the station, and this time they just straight up ask him about Corey's murder. And he, of course, he denies it. And he also denies that he had ever set foot in her apartment. So police are like, well, that's crazy, because your blood was found on the inside and the outside of Corey's window. So if you've never been there, how did it get there?
Yeah.
And of course, Robert can't explain that. And he also couldn't explain why people confirmed that the gold Zippo lighter found in Corey's apartment had definitely belonged to Robert. Like, they could, whoever ID'd it could tell by, like, the emblem. Remember I said there was a specific emblem or logo? They knew it was his.
That's cool, though.
Yeah. But again, he keeps denying any involvement. But almost 2 years to the day that Corey was murdered, Robert Denny was charged with first-degree murder. Now, it would take several years to make it to court, but the trial finally began in 2005. So this is like 7 years after the murder.
Yeah.
And the prosecutor told the court that Robert had become obsessed with Corey Parker. He watched her day in and day out. Like, he could see through her blinds, and he was just, and that was who probably had been creeping outside her apartment.
I'm sure.
So he just had watched her day in and day out. And that Wednesday night, Thanksgiving Eve, Robert had been watching Corey and he saw her leave to go out to the bar. So while she's out, he took a knife, he put on gloves, and he proceeded to crawl in her kitchen window and hide in her apartment, probably in like her bedroom closet, which just gives me like goosebumps.
Yeah.
But they believe that he hid until she fell asleep and then attacked her. But police and prosecutors believe that Robert was, like, completely shocked by how hard Corey fought him, which the struggle led to A, his lighter falling out of his pocket, and B, it led to him cutting himself while stabbing her because it gets slippery, and that led to his DNA being on that windowsill.
Probably why he stabbed her over 100 times, because he was so angry that she was fighting back so hard. He was probably so amped up at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Could explain all of that overkill, too.
Absolutely. But he's still denying everything. But when the jurors are sent out to deliberate, they spend a whopping 45 minutes deliberating and ultimately determined Robert was guilty of first-degree murder in the stabbing death of Corey Lynn Parker.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of murder in the first degree as charged in the indictment. We, the jury, further find that the killing was done with premeditation.
And that should tell you something. If they only deliberated 45 minutes, it was pretty clear cut. Yeah.
That's wild. Like 45 minutes.
Well, if he's lying in wait, and especially like he, think about Robert's perspective, though. He could be in there. If she was a young single girl, she could have went to a dude's house and stayed there overnight. Like he could have been waiting in that apartment all night long for her. She could have been killed in the morning when she got home. Like that's this guy's a creep.
It's so scary.
Yeah.
Well, when it came time for sentencing, his age at the time of the murder did have to be taken into consideration because he was only 17 at the time, so he couldn't be sentenced to death, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's a very adult crime, though.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you're an adult, now act like it and do your time.
Yeah.
But on May 9th, 2005, he was LWOP'd.
Boom.
Life without the possibility of parole.
Nice.
He still denies everything to this day. On that, he was on the Dateline episode, and
really?
He claims that the cops set him up because of what his brother did. And so the Dateline interviewer is like, but what about like your DNA and the saliva and the blood? And Robert's like, oh, it's a mix-up at the crime labs. They didn't follow procedure.
That's why you're hiding your cigarette butts and stuff. Get out of here.
Exactly. So, well, wait. Then the Dateline woman's like, so two separate labs, including the labs at the FBI, they all messed up two different samples? And he's like, yup. And she's basically like, sure, Jan. So,
in case you haven't realized by now, these killers will say anything to keep their names untarnished. Yeah.
He's such a little weasel. Mm-hmm. He has tried to appeal. It's all been denied. However, as of that Dateline episode, which like I said, was 2017 or 2018, the courts did determine that his sentence wasn't fair because he was a minor, you know, like the whole life without parole, blah, 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 blah.
You know what's not fair? Is taking the life of somebody that you can't have, somebody you were just creeping on that you knew you'd never get. So that's what's not fair.
Yeah. So go screw yourself. So he's supposed to get resentenced, but right before we came on, I like looked him up and he's definitely still in jail. So like the resentencing hasn't happened and hopefully it won't.
No. Yeah.
And as of this recording, he is still in prison currently at, I apologize if I butcher this, Okeechobee Correctional Institute.
Okeechobee.
And
yep.
FYI, don't try to visit him because first of all, ew. But second of all, his visitation rights have been suspended. I found that on his inmate page.
It's probably best that you're not, no one seriously. Can see him. God. Well, that's Melissa. Thank you for. Oh.
Oh, I was just going to say he's still maintaining his innocence, blah, blah, blah. But.
Well, that was a good job, Melissa, getting that one together. I know we were under the gun a little bit, but it was. That's a story that I obviously had been around if it was on Forensic Files. And you know what? Depending on what year it was, I might have shot a few things. Like I was also doing some camera work for them. So I'll bet you the reason it sounds familiar, I used to shoot pictures and I'll give an example later on of what I used to do. But I used to see all of the victims come through, whether it was my story or not. So that could be why that looks sound so familiar. But crazy, crazy story. And I love the fact that there was a technique used, like getting spit off the top of a puddle. Incredible.
Isn't that incredible. Wild?
Yeah. So cool.
Well, and I just feel like it's, you know, when you first kind of read the case, you think it's going to be pretty cut and dry. And then all of a sudden it's like this girl who had so many friends and was such a positive influence kind of had not such great people like that became suspects. Like it's wild that there were so many suspects they kind of had to look at.
It's true. And you know what, though, when there's this male DNA found now, you hit that point earlier in the story where they have to now test everybody that's associated with that person. Super cool story. And so what do we have coming up next week? We start a new block next week. I was a little unprepared for what to tease.
Yeah, we do have a new block. Can we tell people what the block is?
Totally. Get excited.
All right. It is Podcaster Killed the Radio Star. That's the title of the block, and we will be covering murders committed by or committed against radio and or television personalities.
Yep, and it's a little nod to a music video that debuted on MTV back in 1981, but also it's a tease about our guests at the end of the month. So, and I said guests plural, so we will give you a little more as we go on here.
Double the fun with our guests.
Absolutely. So stay tuned and stay connected with us on socials, which can be found where, Melissa?
You can find us on Facebook, Insta, and TikTok at Murder Unscripted. You can shoot us an email at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can drop us a line through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. And while you're at it, tell us what you felt, how you felt about the opening of this episode versus the one we normally do.
Yeah, otherwise we're just going to keep trying stuff until somebody comments and says, we like this, this, and this. Don't just leave us to try stuff.
Yeah, we're not that creative.
Who knows what you'll get?
Yikes. Well, that is it for today. So until next week, stay safe, be kind, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
They do look in apartment windows, though. Beware.
That they do.
Yep. Yeah.